Chapter 19. There appeared to be a commotion up Broadway when Isaac Bell and Marion Morgan stepped out of Rector's. They heard clanging fire bells and police whistles and saw crowds of people milling in every direction and decided the best way to Marion's ferry was to take the subway. Uptown in 20 minutes, they walked to the pier holding hands. Bell escorted her aboard the boat and lingered on the gangway. The whistle blew. "Thank you for dinner, darling. It was lovely to see you. Shall I come across with you? I have to get up so early. So do you. Give me a kiss." After a while, a deckhand bawled, "Break it up, lovebirds! All ashore that's going ashore!" Bell stepped off and called as the water widened between the boat and dock, "They say it may shower on Friday." "I'll do a rain dance." He rode the subway downtown and stopped at the Knickerbocker to check in with the Van Dorn night watch, who asked, "Did you hear about the snake?"
"Lacasey Smuta."
"He escaped."
"From the Cumberland?"
"They think he made it down to the sewer."
"Bite anybody?"
"Not yet," said the nightman.
"How'd he get loose?"
"I've heard 14 versions of that since I came on tonight. The best one is they dropped his box. It was made of glass."
He shook his head and laughed.
"Only in New York."
"Anything I should know before morning?"
The nightman handed him a stack of messages. On top was a cablegram from Bell's best friend, Detective Archie Abbott, who, in return for an extended European honeymoon leave, was making contacts in London, Paris, and Berlin to establish Van Dorn field offices overseas. Socially prominent and married to America's wealthiest heiress, the blue-blooded Archibald Angle Abbott IV was welcome in every embassy and country estate in Europe. Bell had already cabled him with instructions to use that unique access to get an inside perspective on the dreadnought race. Now Archie was coming home. Did Bell prefer he take the British Lusitania or the German Kaiser Wilhelm der Große? "Rolling Billy," Bell cabled back, using the popular name for the grand but lubberly German liner. Archie and his beautiful bride would spend their Atlantic crossing in the first-class lounges, charming high-ranking officers, diplomats, and industrialists into speaking freely on the subjects of war, espionage, and the naval race. Neither the stiffest Prussian officer nor the worldliest Kaiser's courtier would stand a chance when Lillian started batting her eyes. While Archie, a confirmed bachelor until he had fallen head over heels for Lillian, was no slouch in the wife-beguiling business. John Skelly had left an enigmatic note. "The P.S. boys are babysitting Kent. I got a mind to nose around Chinatown." Bell tossed it in the wastebasket. In other words, he'd hear from the detective when Skelly felt like it. Reports from the Van Dorn agents in Westchester and Bethlehem offered no new news about the climbing accident and the steel mill explosion. Neither had gotten a line on their possible suspects, the Irish girl or the German millworker. But the agent in Bethlehem warned against jumping to conclusions. It seemed that no one who knew Chad Gordon was surprised by the accident. The victim was an impatient, hard-driving man, casual about the safety rules, and known to take terrible risks. There was disturbing news from Newport, Rhode Island. The Protection Services agent assigned to Wheeler at the Naval Torpedo Station reported chasing off, but failed to capture, two men who tried to break into the torpedo expert's cottage. Bell ordered up extra PS boys, fearing it had not been an ordinary burglary attempt. He also wired Captain Falconer, recommending that Wheeler be instructed to sleep in the well-guarded torpedo station barracks instead of his own place. The middle telephone rang, the one marked with a chorus girl's rouge, and the nightman snapped it up.
"Yes, sir, Mr. Van Dorn."
"As a matter of fact, he's right here."
The nightman passed Bell the telephone, mouthing, "Long distance from Washington." Bell pressed the earpiece to his ear and leaned into the mouthpiece.
"You're working late."
"Setting an example," Van Dorn growled.
"Anything I should know before I turn in."
"Archie's coming home."
"About time. Longest honeymoon I ever heard of."
Bell filled him in on the rest. Then he asked,
How did you make out with your pal at the State Department? That's why I'm telephoning, Van Dorn said. Canning crossed off most of our list's foreigners and added a couple he's got suspicions about. One that catches my eye is some kind of visiting art curator at the Smithsonian Institution, named Yamamoto Kenta. Japanese, just like Falconer says. Might be worth getting a line on him. Have you got someone down there you can send to the Smithsonian? Van Dorn said he did, and they rang off. Bell stifled a yawn as he shrugged into his coat. It was well past midnight. Watch your step passing sewers, said the nightman. I imagine by now Mr. Snake is swimming in the Hudson River. The men's clubs on West 44th Street shared the block between 6th and 5th Avenues with stables and parking garages, and Isaac Bell was too busy sidestepping manure and dodging town cars to worry about snakes. But when he arrived at the limestone and brick 11-story Yale Club of New York City, he found the entrance blocked by three ruddy-faced, middle-aged men, considerably worse for wear from a night on the town, swaying arm in arm on the front steps. Clad in blazers and Class of 83 reunion scarves, the old blues were singing bright college years at the top of their lungs. Isaac Bell lent a sleepy baritone to the chorus and tried to get around them. "We're taller than the Harvard Club," they cried, gesticulating derisively at a squat clubhouse across the street. "Come up to the roof with us. We'll hurl bouquets down upon the crimsons." The doorman came out and cleared a path for the tall detective. Out-of-town members, he marveled. Thanks for the escort, Matthew. Never would have made it inside without you. Good night, Mr. Bell. There was more Yalesian song coming from the grill room in back, though not as loud as the revelers out front. Bell took the stairs instead of the elevator. The grand two-story lounge was typically empty this late at night. He lived on the third floor, which contained 12 Spartan bachelor rooms, 6 on each side of the hall, with the bathroom at the end. A steamer trunk sat in the hall, partly blocking his door. Apparently, a member had just got off the ship from Europe. Yawning sleepily, Bell reached to push the trunk out of his way as he stepped around it. He was surprised it felt light, already empty. The staff usually cleared trunks the instant they were unpacked. He gave it a closer second look. It was a battered old trunk with faded labels from the Hotel Ritz in Barcelona and Browns of London and the Cunard liner Servia. He could not recall the last time he had seen that name. The ship had probably been out of service since the turn of the century. Among the faded luggage check labels, a bright new one caught his eye. The Cumberland Hotel, New York. Funny coincidence. Last known residence of Mr. Snake. He wondered why a member of the Yale Club of New York would stay at the Cumberland before moving to the private but austere bachelor quarters. Most likely a decision to stay long-term in New York, as the rates were considerably lower at the club, even counting the cost of dues. He unlocked his door and took a step into his room. An odd odor tweaked his nostrils. It was so faint it was almost indiscernible. He paused, his hand already outstretched, feeling for the wall switch to turn on the overhead light. He tried to identify the gamey aroma. Almost like a sweaty pigskin fencing suit. But his was around the corner on 45th Street, hanging in his locker with his foils and saber at the Fencers Club. The light from the hall spilled over his shoulder. Something on the bed glistened. Isaac Bell was suddenly wide awake. He bounded sideways into the room so as not to present a silhouette in the open door. Flattened against the wall with all his senses on high alert, he whipped his Browning pistol from his shoulder holster and hit the light switch. On the narrow bed was a box made of glass, so heavy that it pressed deep into the chenille spread. It was cube-shaped, about 24 inches on each side. Even the lid was glass. It was open. It dangled from sprung hinges as if whoever had opened it had hastily dropped the heavy slab, which had bent the metal hinges, and run for his life. Bell felt the hairs rise on the back of his neck.
He shot a swift look around the small room. The dresser top was empty but for a box of his cufflinks. On the night table was a reading lamp, a pocket guide to New York, Mayen's The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, and Burgoyne's Submarine Navigation. The door to the closet was closed and the small safe in the corner where he stored his weapons locked. Still pressing his back to the wall, Bell peered again at the glass box itself. The interior was mostly obscured by reflections on the glass. Slowly, he moved his head to view it from different angles. The box was empty. Bell stood still as a hunter. There was only one place the snake could be hiding, and that was under the bed in the dark space hidden by the overhanging bedspread. Suddenly, he saw movement. A long forked tongue flickered from under the bedspread, testing the air for motion at which to strike. Tight against the wall, moving in minute increments, Bell eased toward the door to get out of the room and lock the reptile inside. Chloroform poured under the door would put it out of action. But before he had moved half a foot, the viper's tongue began flickering faster as if it were about to make its move. He braced to hurl himself out the door in one jump. Just as he was about to spring, he heard the elevator door open. The old blues tumbled into the hall, bellowing, "Where'er upon life's sea we sail, for God, for country, and..." Isaac Bell knew he had no choice. If he shouted for the alums to run, the old boys weren't sober enough to understand even if they heard him. At the same time, his warning would either spook the creature into striking him or send it slithering out the door straight at them. He reached to the side with the barrel of his pistol and used it to swing the door shut. The air it stirred aroused the lance head. In a sudden blur of motion, it shifted position under the bed and flew at his leg. Bell had never moved so fast. He kicked out at the pointed head blazing toward him. The snake smashed against his ankle with an astonishingly muscular impact, staining his trouser cuff with a splash of yellow venom. Only his own animal reflexes and the fact that his boot covered his ankle saved Bell's life. In the space of a breath, the animal spun itself into a tight coil and struck again. By then, Bell was airborne. Diving for the bed, he grabbed the pillow and threw it at the snake. The snake struck, spraying the pillow yellow and leaving two deep holes in the cloth. Bell ripped the spread off the bed, twirled it like a toreador, and flung it over the snake to trap it in the cloth. The snake slithered out from under, coiled again, and tracked Bell with malevolent eyes. Bell raised his pistol, aimed carefully at its head, and fired. The snake attacked at the same instant the gun roared, striking so swiftly that Bell's bullet missed and smashed the dresser mirror. As glass flew, the snake's needle-sharp fangs struck Bell in the chest, directly over his heart.